Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. There was a piece that was written by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic called Why Precisely is Bernie Sanders Against Reparations? And it was a very fascinating piece and has caused this huge explosion of articles and conversations that we're going to tackle here on the Steiner Show this hour. But let me first play for you the quote that Bernie Sanders gave to a commentator who interviewed him about reparations that launched the article by Ta-Nehisi Coates and is launching this conversation.
A lot of African Americans are starting to call for reparations for the many years of stolen labor through slavery. Is that something that you would support as president?
No, I don't think so. I think it would be, first of all, its likelihood of getting through a Congress is nil. Second of all, I think it would be, very divisive. I think the real issue is when we look at the poverty rate among the African American community, when we look at the high unemployment rate within the African American community, the incarceration rate within the African American community, we have a lot of work to do. So I think what we should be talking about is making massive investments in rebuilding our cities, in creating millions of decent paying jobs, in making public colleges and universities tuition free, and working on child care. Basically, targeting our federal resources to the areas that it is needed the most, and where it is needed the most are in impoverished communities, often African American and Latino.
So that was the quote that actually started this conversation off via Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece in The Atlantic. And we are joined here this hour by Adar Ayura, project manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. Dr. Lester Spence, the Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, for which we will soon be having a very lengthy conversation with Dr. Spence. Bill Fletcher, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of blackcommentary.com, co-author of The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, 1934 to 1941, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and New Path for Social Justice. And Bill Lester and Adar, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be
here. Great to be on.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on our Facebook page. People have sent interesting articles to read. I read one that you sent this morning that Dave Eberhard sent that I found fascinating. 410-319-8888 is the number here. One of the things that I thought about in contemplating this, I first of all reread very slowly and like 10 times aloud to myself, Between the World and Me by Richard Wright, which was the title copy of Ta-Nehisi's book, just to get a flavor for Ta-Nehisi's heart in reading that poem. And we don't have time to read the entire poem on the air today. But what I thought about was that, you can get rid of capitalist exploitation and not ever be rid of racism. You can get rid of racism, but it won't get rid of capitalist exploitation. And part of that battle over what we're talking about in America, and what Bernie Sanders wrote and what Ta-Nehisi's response is, I think, is the difficulty that America has in trying to find out where that struggle is and what it means for all of us in this country. Bill Fletcher, can I start with you?
Absolutely. So first of all, appreciate being invited. I think that we really have the issues of race and class here, and I'm glad that this debate is emerging.
Yeah.
The piece that Ta-Nehisi wrote in terms of reparations, I would say that what is significant in that article is less whether or not he and Sanders disagree on reparations. I sincerely believe that honest people can disagree. I think that what's more significant is, first of all, the very last paragraph of that article, which we can come back to. And the second thing is that Coates is basically saying to Sanders, if you're going to talk about repairing the damage that has been done to us, you're not going to be able to do this with a catch-all economic program. that there's going to have to be specific measures taken to address this. And I think that he is, as the Brits would say, spot on. It's absolutely, there's no question about it. But there's a long history in the United States of many progressives and people on the left who will think, instead of addressing race, they basically think that by economic programs that will benefit us, certainly, that that's enough. And I think what Coates is saying is that historically that's proven not to be enough. Now, I don't think that Coates addresses enough about the ills of capitalism, but that's a different, though very, very important discussion.
Adar Ayira.
I agree with Bill, and it's always very interesting the way that we kind of juxtaposition the two as if it were an either or, and it's not. But we have to get to the root of the issue, which is, are reparations due? Let's not talk about how they're due. Let's not talk about how it can be done. Let's take a look at the history of the country and talk about the real issue that caused the inequities that we see today, including the class inequities. In our society, class operates within the paradigm of race, not the other way around, and social indicators support that. So his comments about it being divisive, why is it divisive? Let's look at that. It says something when 90% or almost 90% of whites oppose repair, and when there are a great percentage of African descendants and others who support repair. So we have to start moving back, going deeper into the conversations to really talk about what is the undercurrent in which these discussions take place.
Lester Spence?
I have a slightly different take.
Okay.
First, in the spirit of what Brother Fletcher suggested, it's not just about reading, focusing just on that last paragraph of what Coates wrote in regards to Sanders. It's also focusing on what he wrote afterwards, right? So the piece he writes after he talks about Sanders is actually about Clinton. So he's not simply making a critique of Sanders on the left of the Democratic Party. He's also making a critique of Clinton and the on to the extent Clinton represents kind of sort of the center right of the Democratic Party. So it's a broader critique of the Democratic Party in general, and we're focusing on reparations largely because it's clickbait, and I don't quite like that. So that's the first thing. Second is, it's important to note that he's not telling black people how to vote, right? He's making kind of a moral critique suggesting that the Democratic Party, left and right, should be more attentive to the issues of racism as it works in American life. And to the extent folks should cast a vote, they should do so recognizing whoever they vote for within the Democratic Party isn't going to be their savior. That's really, really important. Because, again, we're just focusing on the Sanders critique, and we're totally missing the critique about Clinton, right? And then thirdly, though, the challenge from the from Sanders' perspective, and he could have been a lot better at saying this, is that when he says it's divisive, what he's suggesting is that while we can chart a political program that goes from A to Z to say how we get something really, really hard like single-payer health insurance passed, it's not possible, the way the world is currently constituted, to figure out a path from A to Z to figure out how we create a policy that basically says to a working-class white person out in Dundalk that you have to pay some black person on the east side of Baltimore. And I'm simplifying it, of course, but there is no – those two impossibilities are very different impossibilities.
So wait a minute. Let me pick up your last sentence. I was going to read that last paragraph and the retort from Freisendorf, who's another writer and an editor at Atlantic, to Ta-Nehisi's piece where he took Bernie Sanders' side. I'll get to that in a moment. But let me pick up what you just said, Lester, and let's wrestle with that for a moment about the impossibility question here. between reparations and things like single payer, which may be two kind of examples of what Ta-Nehisi was talking about in terms of if one is impossible and the other is impossible, it doesn't mean we shouldn't fight for both because we need them. So can we talk about it in that context? I mean, let me go back to you, Lester, and then jump back to Bill and Adara, just to flesh that out a bit more.
Well, I mean, yes, we can, from a standpoint of a moral actor making an intellectual critique, and that's what Coates is doing, and he's very good at it, right? So from the standpoint of somebody making a moral critique, yes. From the standpoint of somebody politically organizing, no. I mean, not if you're organizing black populations, maybe, but if you're organizing and running for an office that requires the vote of the majority of the American public, then no. Then no.
So,
at best, what you can suggest is that what we need to fight for are very specific programs that deal with anti-black policing, that deal with redlining in certain ways. But no, you don't argue for No, you don't. I'll just leave it at that. No, you don't.
Okay. So, and was that Bill? Go ahead, Bill, and then I'll go to Adar.
Yeah. No, I have great respect for Brother Spence, but I disagree with him on this. See, I think that I don't want to hear about what's impossible anymore. We're not supposed to be free. I mean, really, that was impossible at one point. And so the issue is one of strategy and timeline. So I'm not particularly critical of Sanders for not supporting reparations as such. But you see, Sanders could have given a very different response. And there's also the separate issue of strategy around it. Sanders could have given a response that would have gone something like this. I don't particularly agree with reparations, but it is absolutely clear that the damage that has been done to black America over hundreds of years must be repaired. It must be repaired, and there need to be specific steps that are taken to repair that damage, because what we've done so far has simply put not succeeded. Sanders could have said that. He could have, right? Now, for those of us that are organizing, I think that I look at what Lester was saying as a challenge, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. I think that where I've been critical of many people in the reparations movement is for the lack of a political strategy. It is, that I think that too often there's many people, and people of goodwill, that treat reparations as a flag that they pull up on the pole and they look to see who will salute, rather than looking at it as an actual campaign, the same way that we had campaigns against lynching, campaigns around voting rights, etc., that you need to build a campaign. And it's not enough to go around asking people, do you stand for reparations? We've got to translate this into a real reform agenda that builds on things like what Congressman Conyers has done, but goes much beyond that.
Adar?
You know what? If Sanders had given either of the two answers that Bill or that Lester gave, this would be a very different conversation. But the fact is that he didn't. He is very articulate in stating his positions, and he stated his position. Why we are explaining it, adding to it, interpreting it is beyond me. He said what he wanted to say and what he believed about that. And there is deeper conversation there that we should be exploring, as opposed to talking about what he meant to say, as opposed to what it was that he said.
So, folks, do join us here at 410-319-8888. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. It's a really critical debate on where we're going, and I think where the larger progressive movement's going, and where the communities of color in that movement and white people in that world are coming together, and how that or not coming together, and what that says about how we develop the future. Let's talk a bit about what Bill Fletcher just raised here, just as we did about what Lester just raised here. So what does it mean to translate reparations into a strategy? when it comes to organizing and what kind of, you know, I was thinking, and Andar and I have talked about this in the air before together, that in the 60s, when I was a young organizer, and we were organizing in Uptown Chicago, which was a poor white Appalachian neighborhood populated by a number of people who had formerly been in the Klan, some of them, and ended up making a coalition with the Black Panthers and Young Lords and more in Chicago, and then was able to begin to wrestle with issues of race, reparations if it came up. The same thing happened when we were organizing here in South Baltimore with the first interracial tenants group that took on slumlords in South Baltimore. But they had never come together before. But that's one way of thinking about organizing. Well, when you talk about reparations, which is really hard for most of America to put their hands around, what does it mean to build a strategy? How do you do that? I'm curious. Well, what those, go ahead. You can start, Bill, if you listen, since you jumped in. Go ahead, and we'll just go around.
See, I think one of the things, Mark, is that the fight around reparations is an ideological and a practical fight. Germany is paying reparations to Jews for the Holocaust, and they should. And the government of the various governments of Germany have essentially had to articulate that there is this Holocaust that we have to address. We have to address the ramifications of that. Well, in effect, the Holocaust was committed against African people of African descent.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the difficulties is that when you live in a society that keeps avoiding that question, that keeps avoiding the discussion of the Holocaust that was committed against us and against Native Americans, then it's very easy for people to say, well, why should we be paying them something? Why don't they just get off their asses and do some work? Because all of this lacks historical context. The second thing is that then there's a practical side to it. So, for example, one of the things that Coates was very good at pointing out in earlier writings, specifically on reparations, and was raised by other people like Randall Robinson and others, is that, you know, there were very specific measures taken by different institutions like banks that we're still living with the consequences. So when we talk about the penalties that need to be brought against the banks for what happened in the lead up to the 2007-2008 collapse, we also should be talking about what steps are going to be taken to get the banks to address what was done to Black America. So you actually can link these fights together and make it part of a total reform program. That's what we need to be doing, but we can't act as if simply articulating some general progressive schema for how we're going to work with the banks will resolve or address the years of injustices committed against us.
Mm-hmm. Adar, I heard that. Go ahead. Then we'll go to Lester.
So there have been models for repair put forward by different groups in the country. Those models have not been explored in terms of political will, what is feasible, what is not. They have not really been vetted. We all know it is almost so predictable to talk about now Conyers Bill, H.R. 40, which has been languishing or hit language for 20-some years, even just a bill to look at the issue, not even to do anything about, just to look at the issue, and we didn't have political will around that. We ignored the ways in which repair has been given to other communities. We even ignore the way that a repair was given to enslavers, what was called what compensated emancipation, I think, where enslavers in Washington, D.C. were actually paid as compensation for the people that they could no longer enslave. So there are models in our society already which speak to the issue. We lack the political will to look at and to seriously give weight to this question. And again, I keep saying that we have to look at the undercurrent of conversation, of stereotype, of thought, of belief about whether African descendants are deserving, because that is the big barrier that keeps us from moving this conversation forward in a very real and practical way.
Lester, I mean, could you leap in here on this as well? I mean, I think that the question of how the broader society in America is able to honestly wrestle with this is a serious question.
Yeah, and so I think there's actually a lot more agreement here. There's still some disagreement, but
right.
There's more agreement here that I think we're articulating. So when Bill and Doris, when they say basically that the program lacks political will, and to a certain extent even flesh, right? So Ta-Nehisi, so Coates is really, really effective, again, in making a moral claim, and they're really effective in talking about how this stuff is contemporary rather than just historical. But he isn't really, that's not what he does. He's not really promoting a policy. It's like, we can't simply say, this is what we're due, other people have it, henceforth, it's appropriate to argue for it politically. No, you have to make the case, you have to organize for it, right? So in the absence of that organizing, right? In the absence of that organizing, we should not expect, we should expect an actor like Sanders on the left to say, okay, this is something, like Bill said, this is something I don't quite agree with, but there is this kind of racial residual that dealing with the class stuff simply won't deal with, right? At best, we can expect that. But we shouldn't expect that as a matter of practice. That's something we have to work for. And that's kind of that's on people who believe that reparations is something we really need to deal with. That's on something for them to do. That's the challenge.
So
and
Mark,
if you don't have that, if people aren't stepping up to that challenge, mm-hmm. then no, we shouldn't have that.
So, Mark, that negates the years of organizing that has happened in this country around the issue of repair, starting from Callie House. My goodness, there has always been groups who have organized around the issue of repair. And historically, those groups, those people, those arguments have been shut down in every legal way. So it is just in, this after, the 1960s or so, and Bill, please correct me if I'm wrong, where there have been more avenues where doors have opened very, very slightly to consider the issue. And we continue to organize around that. Maybe those organizing efforts are not in the consciousness of mainstream society, but those organizing efforts have always been ongoing. John Conyers' bill has been in the consciousness of society since 1989 and again has been shut down.
Can I step in for a second, Mark? So when I was dissertating in Detroit, there was a brother, he's passed away now. We called him Reparations Ray. He was one of the first people in the modern era to organize for reparations in Detroit. Really good brother. I wish he was alive to see this. It's important to, what I'm going to do is kind of modify my statements a bit. I'm no longer going to talk about mainstream society, the Democratic Party writ large. I'm going to talk about black people. So there is attitudinal, more support within black populations attitudinally for reparations than white ones. But this is the question. How many black communities have voted for reparations or something like it? And I would argue that while it has been in the consciousness of black communities themselves have not supported this with their feet. At best, they've supported it with attitudes. So that suggests that there is that doesn't say that organizing hasn't happened. Organizing has, right? But what it suggests is that organizers actually have a challenge in black communities, not a challenge that goes beyond making black people say, "Wow, this sounds like a good idea." A challenge that goes to electing people who support this as a platform, and supporting policy proposals with their feet and their vote.
So let me jump because we have to take a break in just a moment. But Bill, can you stay for a minute? You have to roll.
Actually, both. I need to roll, but it's safe. So, I really do need to respond to what both of my colleagues said, because this is fantastic.
Well, let me let you respond, and then we're going to take a quick break. And Sonia is our first caller up. We're going to come to your call after we come to the break. So please, Sonia, stay with us. I know you've been holding on for about 10 minutes, but it's gotten so intense. I promise to get to the phones here. But go ahead, Bill.
I'll make this quick.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
See, it seems to me that both comments are invaluable. See, because I think that there's a difference between the organizing that's been going on, that is absolutely the case, and a political strategy. I'm arguing I don't see a political strategy on the part of most reparations advocates. And I'm not saying that to dump on people. I'm saying that it's one thing to raise the flag of reparations, to basically have demonstrations, to write things about it, even to have lawsuits, to raise the Tulsa, Oklahoma case, for example. All of that is important, but at some juncture, there needs to be a strategy committee that says, all right, now, how do we actually move this? How do we move this through Congress? Right? Because we've got to go beyond the Conyers bill. How do we develop the right message? How do we connect the issue of reparations to the injustice that masses of people are facing under capitalism? Right? How do we do that? That's what I'm arguing is a discussion. And so this is not a discussion about how to make white people feel bad. This is not a discussion about guilt-tripping people. This is about how do we win. And yes, that's the discussion that I would love to be part of.
So yes, we do have to take a very brief break. I want to come back to wrestle with that. And there's a quote from Ta-Nehisi's piece at the end and a quote from Connor Friedersdorf, who wrote a piece in The Atlantic, Why Bernie Sanders is Right to Oppose Reparations, that I think sets up this kind of political separation that I think you are speaking to, Bill. How do we cross it and create this common strategy? Therein lies the rub. So we're going to take a short break, and Sonia, we're going to first come back to your thoughts after this very brief break as we wrestle with Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece on reparations in light of Senator Sanders saying he opposed fighting for reparations. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we continue our discussion on the question of reparations as a political strategy, a debate that was actually started by Ta-Nehisi Coates, the present debate in this country, with his article in The Atlantic, and has been intensified with Bernie Sanders' campaign, calling himself a Democratic Socialist, saying that reparations are probably not strategically wise, and Ta-Nehisi Coates responding to that led to a stream of articles and commentaries around this. We are joined by three very serious political thinkers and activists. Adar Ayira, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst of Baltimore Justice Race Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships, Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of a groundbreaking new book called Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, Bill Fletcher, who's senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com, and co-author of The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice. And you at 410-319-8888. I promised that I would go right to the phones for a comment, come back to our guests, and come back to the phones after the commentary. And at 410-319-8888, Sonia, on line two, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm just on that work. I'm listening to you guys. I happen to be mixed also with Native American, probably even some Asian. So my thoughts on this would be like, well, what is the situation in other countries that are similar to this? In other words, part of the problem, I think, is that in America, there's a tendency to just be very narrow-minded. It's a black and white scene in America. And in other countries, it is as well. but it translates a little differently. And, for instance, my experience in Europe with being black has been wonderful. And coming to America in my 20s, I was absolutely and still am culture shocked. Because nobody looks at, you know, commonalities between races. Nobody discusses, you know, classes don't intermingle unless they're doing something bad, usually. So as far as a solution, I'm also artistic, so my angle is like, well, what about arts education, which we already have problems with?
Okay.
Okay? The truth of education isn't being told to people to say, well, hey, yeah, let's talk about this, neither on the white nor the black side. So, I don't know, I'm just putting it out there. The youth, you know, need us to direct them in this path. And frankly, I'm starting to think if we just shut up and watch them, maybe they could direct us.
Thank you, Sonia. What Sonia made me think of was some of the things that I've seen written about this. Darryl Pinckney wrote a really interesting essay in the New York Review of Books that I only read very quickly this morning and shared with the three of you at the last minute. I know you didn't have time to read it, but where he talks about this issue and that race as a construction and racism coming out of our construction of race in this world. And one of the things he writes here is, in American history, Coates finds that the answer to why he believes in the progress of those who think themselves white was built on violence and looting, on stolen black bodies. People were Jewish or Welsh before they were white. The Irish used to be black, socially meaning at the bottom. The gift of being white helped to subdue class antagonisms. Coates, talking about his father, wants his son to know that government of the people had not included his family before, that American democracy is self-congratulatory, and white people forgive the torture, theft, and enslavement for which the country was founded. And in that, I think, in many ways, Lester is the heart of the divide in this country when we try to talk about class and race. And the different perspectives entirely that I think Bill was touching on before we went to break.
Yes, and going back, I want to assert a strong agreement with what he said, and I want to add another layer of complexity. Right. So one argument is that we can't talk about the way race is constructed ends up creating this large group of people who have kind of an embedded class element, right? Like whites, no matter what their background is, are kind of viewed as kind of a higher class, you know, either measured attitudinally or empirically, like life chances and such, than black bodies, right? But what we haven't really talked about at all is, and what I try to usually push in, when I'm on the show and in other places, is a dynamic within black politics, right? That is, that within black communities, there are people with a lot of resources, and then people, this large swath of people with a little bit of resources, right? So yes, there is this dynamic that creates this big difference between whites and blacks, and whites and non-whites in general, but there's also this dynamic within black populations that at best generates kind of a managerial class that seeks to speak on behalf of larger black populations and tell them what they want, when the benefits of those ideas tend to go to that managerial class.
Hmm. Let me go jump to Adar before we come back to Bill. I have another quote here.
Thank you. So I agree with what Lester said.
Hmm.
And there is class within every group, right, or every race of Americans. This is true. But we still get back to something that Lester is talking about, is access and opportunity. He's saying that there are African descendants, some with more access and opportunity, and some with less access and opportunity. The bottom line, though, Mark, is that when we talk about racializations in the United States, what we are also talking about is a greater loss of access and opportunity for African descent and all people who are not classified as white. And because of that, we're also talking about a loss to the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Because the country as a whole loses part of the economic potential and promise of its citizens when it continues on the course of marginalizing them through the racial disparities that it seems to be committed to.
Hmm. So Bill, let me jump to you.
Two things, Mark. One is that to pursue something that you were raising, race was created to obscure class.
Yes.
It has been the most successful mechanism for creating what's been called class collaboration, probably ever developed. As was pointed out, it is scientifically, genetically, completely fraudulent, but politically very, very real. So that's like the backdrop to this entire discussion. The second thing, though, is I want to pick up on something that the caller was raising mm-hmm. and made me think about. This issue of reparations is actually a global issue. I don't mean just in terms of people of African descent. The issue of reparations against people who are the victims of criminality comes up time and again. And it's interesting to look at Japan, because Japan is, in its attitude towards Koreans and Chinese, has fallen exactly into the same kind of headset as white America, which is basically complete denial of the atrocities that were committed against Koreans and Chinese, obscuring history, attempting to dismiss the criminality that was created or carried out by Japanese fascism. And so when you have in political power those that deny history, it becomes that much more difficult to advance a reparations agenda.
So when you have, and I'm gonna pull this quote out, get your thoughts, and then Rashid and Bill and Michael, we're going to come to your calls before the top of the hour. You mentioned at the very top of the show, Bill, that the closing part of Ta-Nehisi's piece, original piece, and I'm going to juxtapose that to the piece that Freisendorf wrote at the end. Let me just read this very quickly. The closing part of Ta-Nehisi's piece is, the last paragraph is, if not even an avowed socialist can be bothered to grapple with reparations, if the question really is that far beyond the pale, if Bernie Sanders truly believes that victims of the Tulsa pogrom deserve nothing, that the victims of contract lending deserve nothing, that victims of debt peonage deserve nothing, that the political plunder of black communities entitle them to nothing, if this is the candidate of the radical left, then expect white supremacy in America to endure well beyond our lifetimes and lifetimes of our children. Reparations is not one of the possible tools against white supremacy. It is the indispensable tool against white supremacy. One cannot propose to plunder a people, incur a moral and monetary debt, propose to never pay it back, and then claim to be seriously engaging in the fight against white supremacy. My hope was to talk with Bernie Sanders directly before writing this article. I reached out repeatedly to his campaign. The Sanders campaign did not respond. But that last paragraph was what you were talking about, and Reisendorf, who agreed with Sanders, said, I argued that the race-neutral remedies to housing discrimination, the drug war, abuse of policing, and other racist policies are superior alternative, politically, practically, and morally, to race-specific remedies if one believes, as I do, that U.S. policies injured black people far more than any other non-indigenous group. Before that, he wrote about how he praised the Black Lives Matter 10-point program because he called that a race-neutral program the way it was written. And that was a paragraph preceding this one. So, I mean, to me, in many ways, this is the heart of the divide. I mean, this is a bridge, I think, that before America can address the bridge, maybe I'm wrong about this, that the so-called progressive world of America has to wrestle with this if it goes forward. And maybe I'm politically
wrong. That's right.
So your thoughts on that? Let's go, Bill Adar Lester. Let's jump in and then I'll get to the phones.
No, you're absolutely right, Mark. And see, what I was talking about was literally the very end of the article. The fact that Coates reached out to the Sanders campaign and did not get a response.
Uh-huh.
See, that to me, that's the most damning thing in this entire exchange.
I agree.
How do you blow off Coates? That's the question I've been asking. How do you blow... Coates is not just somebody that happened to write a letter to the editor
right.
who's sitting in Dover, Delaware, right? I mean, this is a guy who is getting national attention. How do you blow him off? And I think that part of this is that there is a segment of the progressive movement that is so fearful of talking about race that it believes and it insists that the only way we'll deal with things is to find, again, these mega economic demands that benefit everyone. It's very Rooseveltian. But what we have to remember is Roosevelt did a lot of things, improving the living standard of millions of African Americans as well as whites, but there was a whole lot to the New Deal that completely excluded us, specifically because of race.
Adara, and then we'll go to Lester, and I'm going to open the phones here.
You know, and I think the whole attraction around quote-unquote race neutral, because we know that it's not, but the whole attraction around so-called race neutral anything is that it obscures conversations. We do not have to talk about what Bill classified as the criminality of the history of this country in terms of race. If we talk specifically about race, then we do. And it calls into question everything else that we believe about merit, about equal rights, past, post-enslavement. It calls into question the way in which the racial disparities are playing out in our criminal injustice system, our economic systems, the greatest loss of wealth of black people in the 2008 depression. It calls into question the ways in which policies are disproportionately implemented, even though on their face it seems race neutral. So I definitely understand the attraction of that and the political expediency of that. The question is, do we want to continue to go down a road that we know in the end will not serve all citizens, but will only serve a racialized, color-coded percentage of citizens? And that, more than anything about these discussions, that is an important thing about them, because it allows us to make a conscious choice as opposed to the business-as-usual choice that we love to make.
So let me jump to you, and then I do want to, I'm going to get these three callers before the end of the hour and let you kind of all close out here.
Yeah, quickly, I just say that that while Bill is absolutely right about the New Deal policies, that one something like Social Security, which was created to which at the outset did exclude black people in a few different ways, but people consistently fought for Social Security to expand it to the point that it included all black people, right? So, or a larger swath of black workers, every black worker who has a job. Secondly, though, I just want to drive home again the central point, again, forgetting Sanders for a moment. If you can't get a majority of black people to support reparations, something like reparations, with their vote, then that suggests that yes, we have a challenge with a larger community, but if you can't win black people with a political program, then there's significant work that must be done before we get to the level of somebody like Sanders. Finally, but real quick,
I get
Fletcher's frustration with him not reaching out to Coates, and I kind of don't understand it myself. But part of me is like, well, Coates is a writer. I mean, Coates doesn't represent black constituencies in anything other than symbolically. So that's not a politics we should be supporting, right? Where it's like we need Sanders to holler back at Coates. No, that's a bad thing for black people to have somebody who's not elected, who doesn't have an electoral constituency or even an organizational constituency, kind of speaking for black people and what they want.
Yeah, but you holler back, you're not an elected official, right?
Say it again.
I said you holler back, you're not an elected official. I mean, isn't that, and we all do?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't expect people. So, for example, if I were to reach out to Stephanie, to Mayor Rawlings Blake,
yeah,
I wouldn't be, and this is not what Coates is doing. But I wouldn't be like, oh, my God, Mayor Rawlings Blake didn't holler back at me. This means that she basically doesn't like black people. I'd make that claim a different way.
Let me go to the phones and come right back to our guests at 410-319-8888. Rashid, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we don't understand, sir, the Emancipation Proclamation talks about compensation, not reparations. Reparations come under the 14th and the 15th Amendment. So as long as we are under that status, calling ourselves Negro, black, and color, we can talk till the cows come home, because we have not proclaimed our nationality, dealing with Abraham Lincoln's proclamations of emancipation. He gave us 37 years to do what? to proclaim our nationality. Black is not a nationality. That's where we are missing the boat at in this process. We are not talking about a people because Negro, black, and color is not a people. We are Hebrew, Moorish Americans. Mr. Steiner, you talked with us about this some years ago during the 80s. We still on this road of dealing with what? Compensation, and the word is not reparations. This is where we're going down the wrong road, talking about reparations. No, we're talking about compensation. This is what y'all are not dealing with in this process. I'm talking about the senators. We talked with Ron Dellum, all these, Maxine Waters, all these people denied our, what, birthrights. These are birthrights we're talking. Compensation deal with our birthrights, not with a chattel status, which is Negro, black, and colored. There is no such people. So we have to understand the process. We do not understand the process dealing with reparations. We have not proclaimed our nationality, sir.
Okay, Rashid, I appreciate it. We have a lot of callers. I'm trying to get to one more, at least two, so we can have closing thoughts from our listeners. I appreciate you calling in. 410-319-8888. Bill in Northeast, you're on the air. Bill?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, so we're talking about reparations, compensation, society conscious. You know, Mark, one of the things I've always said, and I continue to say, is that we need to demand that a portion of confiscated money that the police confiscate by communities through drug raids, through selling items, everything, come directly back into our community by way of organization or by way of programs that we are in charge of to help to rebuild our community. You know, so I mean, it's like we can create reparations right where we at by forcing local government to push our issues that we have. So I mean, what the brother is saying in terms of political strategy is right. I think that's what we miss, and we do not have a political strategy even on a local level to push our issues to make local government do nothing that's responsible for us as a people.
Bill, thank you for your call, and let's try to get a quick thought here from Michael, and then we're going to get back to our guests. Michael. Michael there? Okay.
Related to the genocide of people of African descent, when we charge genocide like they did in 51. The other thing that's relevant about that is it's a human rights issue, and we talk about class and race. And, you know, as if it's either or, right, when it's both and. It's very African to say both and. It's very European binary to say either or. The last thing I'll say is, you know, this race-neutral nonsense is just not borne out by the numbers. When you look at when you control for poor kids, all poor kids, just look at that. White poor kids are, by high magnitude, less likely to grow up in concentrated poverty than black and people of color kids. What that means is essentially that you can be poor and white and a child, and you can essentially blend into privilege in America. No one likes to talk about that, but that is the data. And that's not happening with race neutral. So we have to look at that square in the face. We have to look at it with a U.S. human rights context. And when you look at public health and what it calls for, you know, racism looks like inaction in the face of need. And that's why we charge genocide, not just the intentional kind, but the slow grinding kind. That is every day in America.
So let me get some final thoughts here from our guests before we end the hour. And I appreciate everybody calling in. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody. It was a very intense discussion. Let me start with Adora Yira.
When the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed, it was not popular. When the Emancipation Proclamation was passed, it was not popular. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was not popular and is not popular now. There are a lot of things that are not popular that are needed, that have a history behind it, and that ultimately serves the greater good of the country and everyone living in the country. Repair for a 100-year crime that truncates access and opportunity for too many people of color, in particular African descendants, is one of those things.
And Dr. Lester Spence.
Yeah, I support. First of all, this has been a great show, and the caller, Michael Scott's my man.
Yes, he is.
And Fletch is my man, and John's my girl. But really quickly, if we take something like you look at a school like the University of Michigan, which I went to, it's clear. You look at that population. Poor people, poor white folk aren't getting into Michigan anymore. Right, and definitely poor black folk aren't. So this isn't just something that whites do end up getting a benefit in the aggregate that places poor whites ahead of blacks. But there are a number of institutions from which poor whites are significantly excluded that allocate power. Right, so a policy like making college education free would help poor whites, but it would help tons of poor blacks, and that's not to act like it won't. But more importantly, again, I just want to drive home the politics within black communities. If we cannot create a program by which black people themselves support, and we're talking about black people who love black people who have good consciousness, black people who are good on every measure that we would define being black on. If we can't do that, I'm not sure why we're talking about getting pushback or getting support from wider populations.
And a final thought in the last couple of minutes here, Bill Fletcher.
Yeah, very quickly. So thank you again for inviting me.
I'm glad you're with us.
No, absolutely. So first, to build on what Dr. Spencer said, being white does not guarantee wealth. It does guarantee that you're not going to be treated like an African-American or a Native American. And I think that is very important, that there is a racial differential in treatment, but there is no guarantee. And I go back to that race was created to obscure class, to obscure the question of who actually controls and holds power. And that's the discussion we have to really get into. And finally, I think that Dr. Spence misunderstood my point about the last part of the Coates article. I'm not looking at Coates as a spokesperson for us. I'm saying this, though, that here you have a critically important discussion within black America. I wanted Bernie Sanders, who is someone I support, to engage in that discussion. I don't like the idea of Coates being blown off. And if it was, and this is not just something that's happened with Coates. I think that the Sanders campaign needs to engage in the debates that are going on within black America, and blowing people off is a real recipe for people deciding that they may just take a pass.
This has been a fascinating...
Real quick, I agree.
Discussion. Bill Fletcher, Dr. Lester Spence, Adar Ayer, I thank the three of you so much for this engaging, important discussion. I would appreciate it very much and look forward to having you all back. Thank you so much and have a lovely weekend.
Pleasure.
Oh, thanks. Talk to all y'all later.
Thank you all so much. And thank you all for writing in and calling in and being part of this conversation as well. On our way to break, I want to remind you, from school funding to testing, you can learn about important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education's website, Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. And I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. We have to take a break. When we come back, it's a new edition of Soundbites. You'll listen to a town meeting we recorded on the Lower Eastern Shore in Virginia with community residents rising up against poultry destroying their communities. Stay with us. We'll be right back.